Fayetteville, Laurinburg, North Carolina, they're watching. Let's go to Holy Blood, the Holy Grail. This priest got me bugged. And what bugs me is not that he had that maid living with him. It's where he got the money. Now, this book, you say, how did you get to this from the pyramid? I'm trying to show you something. That God's had his hand in everything that's going on, and wherever God's trying to do something, Satan comes along and tries to mess it up with his imitation. I'm going to prove that from every area of knowledge. I don't want to save anybody. I just think, yes, I do. I take it back. I'd like to save as many people as I can from being ignorant, but I've learned over most of these years that I've lived, people that don't want to be ignorant usually aren't. It has nothing to do with schooling. You can learn without going to school. I'm tired of television treating everybody like they're ignorant. I think there's more smart people than television believes is there. And since they're aiming to the dummies, I'm glad to shoot for the majority. Will you spread the word? You people that are so tired of miserable, wilderness, stupid television, turn to where you're watching. And this interests me. Rennes Le Chateau, June 1st, 1885, the tiny French village of Rennes Le Chateau received a new parish priest. It was like he was banished. Between 1885 and 1891, he was just a regular priest. Just a regular priest, except he did... Is this regular? He employed as housekeeper and servant an 18-year-old peasant girl named Marie. Well, that's his business. And lived on $30 a year, roughly, £6 a year. He pastored a church in South France in a little town, village, Rennes Le Chateau, on top of a hill in that area called the Languedoc, north of Marseille, in those valleys and foothills in the eastern Pyrenees that divide Spain and France. In 1891, he decided to restore his little church that was consecrated to Mary Magdalene. Now, the thing that's amazing about South France is that's where the whole household of Bethany is memorialized. Lazarus, raised from the dead, first bishop, tradition says, of Marseille. Martha and Mary both are memorialized up that whole southern French valley, as several others of the closest companions of Christ, and they're not memorialized anywhere else. The traditions have them spend their life within 6 years after the resurrection of Jesus in South France. He's pastoring a church dedicated to her. 1891. 6 years after he comes to town, living on a paltry $30 a year. He started rebuilding the church, restoring it, removed the altar stone inside the church, rested on two archaic Visigoth columns. One of the columns proved to be hollow. Inside, he found four parchments preserved in sealed wooden tubes. Some of the parchments had genealogies. Some of the parchments had offset, off-the-line letters that had codes. Some of the codes could be deciphered. Some didn't. It mentioned, one of the enigmatic messages said, to Dagobert II. Write that down because you're going to crop out again. To Dagobert II, king, and to Zion belongs this treasure. And he is there dead. Now, what in the heck does that mean? What does that mean? He went to Paris at his bishop's initiative. Stayed 3 weeks, that's all he stayed. It's rumored he became the lover of Emma Calvé, the Maria Callas of her day, the diva. He gets involved in esoteric circles, becomes an associate of Emil Hoffet. His reputation was in linguistics, cryptography, and paleography. Comes back and starts spending like he's Howard Hughes. Millions. His postage. In 1 year, his postage expenditures were more than all of his income the previous 6 years. He builds a big tower to Mary Magdalene. He builds a big villa, Bethania. Never lives in it. Becomes a great collector of valuable things. The cousin of the Archduke comes down, and the bank records of the day show a major deposit made to him from the relative of the Archduke of Austria. He's accused by his bishop of selling indulgences. They're going to defrock him. He appeals to the Pope, and the Pope says, take your hands off of him. Leave him alone. 5 days before, he is stricken with illness, a strange illness. His girlfriend, Marie, buys a coffin for him. He's as well as a bird flying. Too cold in here. He dies on a day that is very significant. We'll skip over that. Everybody waits here at a strange funeral. They wrap him in brightly colored clothes and prop him up in a chair, tassels all over, and everybody marches by and pulls the tassels off. Strangest funeral I've ever read about. Everybody waits for his will to be read. Where's all the money? His will reveals him to be a pauper. He put everything in Marie, his housemaid's hands. I mean, all indications are all Emma Calvé got was him. You want to make sure you're alert. The maid got it all. The war ends. This is recent history. France issues new money to expose those that collaborated with the war effort. You can get all your old money transformed into new money, one-to-one. You don't lose any money. You just have to tell where you got your money. She is seen in the front yard of Villa Bethania burning sheaves of old money in barrels rather than reveal where it came from. To live, she sells Villa Bethania, lives off of the sale proceeds, tells the buyer that she can tell him a story, promises to do it. That will not only bring him wealth, but power. She has a stroke, rendered speechless, and dies without saying a word. The secret goes down with her. Now, the thesis of this book is, I don't know how much you know about the Holy Grail, but there's two traditions of the Holy Grail. There's the European stream. And the German writers that put mystical meaning on the Holy Grail. And there's the simplest theme of the King Arthur legends, but there are a great many who also will place those legends on the continent. What is the Grail? And it's run the gamut from the cup in which the Lord's Supper gave participation, carried the Joseph of Arimathea to catch the drop of blood off of the cross, to an ideal for a life, to many other things. The thesis of this book, and the Grail romances, by the way, you can't understand medieval history without understanding the Grail romances, and yet not one out of 100 people know anything about it, except that little simple part I've just named. The thesis of this book is that Holy Grail, San Grado. The G should be moved over, and it should change to San Real. Holy blood. And that the secret that was discovered was proof, absolute proof. That's the thesis of this book. Absolute proof that Jesus didn't die on the cross, and that Mary Magdalene was his lover. And some of the Gnostic Gospels tend to support that, which is why you better know a little bit about Gnosticism and apocryphal literature before you pay too much attention to what's coming in the mail. Now, you'll get a lot of books, for example. You get a lot of mail is pouring out all over the country right now for the lost books or the forgotten books of the Bible. Where in the heck is it? I was going to read you a section of one of them tonight, but I don't want to slow down. You better be careful and listen to me. Then you'll know how to sort it out. I'll get to them all eventually. I travel slowly, but occasionally I can speed up, and you'll be grabbing the saddle horn and want me to slow down. And there are plenty here that will witness to that. Now, this book's thesis is Mary Magdalene carried the natural born son of Jesus. And the Holy Grail was in fact holy blood. And that what this priest discovered was absolute proof that Jesus never died on the cross, and that his line as the King of Zion is still alive somewhere in Europe. And they are speculating that the church could not afford this absolute proof to be revealed. They, for example, take their story to a fellow in Britain who says he has absolute, indisputable proof of this. Well, I want to tell you something. That is horse spit. And there are pastors who have been scared to death you'd find this book. It's what's called the Protestant Index. I deliberately dive into this because a faith that this book can destroy maybe needs to be reorganized anyway. It is the reason it's been so powerful in the bestseller, and so powerful in shaking people's faith is it is well written. And it is one of the most accurate, gestalted synthesis of medieval history you're going to find. You don't have to reach their interpretive conclusion. There are other explanations. Now, what are they? We'll see, won't we? Now, they posed the question, and they didn't just pose it. I mean to tell you, it has been the rage in France since the late 1940s. A crescendo in the 50s, this book and the BBC popularized it. Students of medieval history and some of the secret societies have been aware of this for some time. Now, it is a mystery. How could this priest find something, go to France, 3 weeks later be Howard Hughes of Europe? Die a pauper, his girlfriend's burning barrels of money rather than reveal where she got it. She dies, nobody knows the secret. What did he uncover? Well, most likely he didn't uncover something that was put there after he died. That's just simple logical deductive elimination. That damn transmitter. You can't get between me and it, apparently. I'd say this rat of a guy occasionally, he's a marvelous fellow, but he has ratty tendencies. Likes to sneak up behind me, and it's too hot in here now. Likes to sneak up behind me and try to read ahead of me. See, if he could get behind me, He would tell you what the head was on. The Lord decided to give me a warning. The Lord is protecting this secret until I'm ready to reveal it. He can't walk between me and that little transmitter for my little cordless microphone. Thank the Lord. He obviously discovered something put there by somebody else, and most likely it has the nature of a secret rather than just monetary treasure. It has a nature about it as something that you didn't have to get trucks to haul it around. But whomever had it could get some money from people who had it, who had money. If you had what he had, people who had money would give you money. What was it? Well, we looked at the Cathars. They obviously had a treasure of two kinds. Money that was slipped out a few weeks before Montsegur, the last mountain fortress to fall, and that first genocide of the people of South France in the Albigensian Crusade that was launched in the Middle Ages to wipe out the Cathar heresy. They were Gnostics, and we've been talking about that. They slipped another treasure other than money. It had some kind of religious significance because they wouldn't make their move until they kept it long enough for their annual religious holiday associated with certain mysteries to occur. Then at risk of the whole garrison, four men went down the sharp cliff face and escaped. Nobody knows where they went with it. We already covered that. Now, the Knights Templar, I sort of raced through them last night. If you take medieval history in college, they will tell you, because they're hurrying through it, that William of Tyre, Williame of Tyre, who wrote between 1175 and 1185, is the first source of information about the Knights Templar. They were knights, and they got their name, allegedly, because they set up their first residence on the Temple Hill in Jerusalem. Now, can I work you a little bit tonight as I move back to this Templar, the necrophiliac who crept to that grave? He wrote at least 50 years after the Knights Templar were formed. He gives a date saying it was founded in 1118. You want to write it down? 1118 A.D. That's his record. He says, one day, Hugues de Payen, unsolicited, presented himself with eight comrades to the palace of Baudouin the First, king of Jerusalem. His elder brother, Godfrey de Bouillon, had captured the holy city 19 years earlier from the Turks. He was received cordially. The Patriarch of Jerusalem, the religious leader, the special emissary of the Pope, received him. Their stated objective was that, so far as their strength permitted, they'd keep the roads and highways safe with a special regard for the protection of pilgrims. So worthy was this objective, that they would protect the pilgrims now making their trips back to the Holy Land. The king vacated an entire wing of the royal palace and placed it at the knight's disposal. According to tradition, their quarters were built on the foundations of the ancient Temple of Solomon. And from this, the fledgling order derived its name, Knights Templar. You cannot understand. I doubt seriously you can understand Freemasonry without understanding Knights Templar. Sure can't understand medieval history. For 9 years, William of Tyre, the alleged principal and initial authoritative historian on them, tells us the nine knights admitted no new candidates to their order. Now, one of the things that I never tire of doing is pointing out how fragile scientific theories and history are. We grew up in an age, I lost my faith because I grew up in an age where everybody said, I still remember one snide professor of mine, I stood outside of a room and watched him talking to some other associates saying, faith! I can't stand anything that requires faith. So I thought to be intellectual, I would have to find a philosophy that had no faith and a way of life that had no faith. Now, the fellow was a good English professor, but it took me many years to discover he was a jackass on other subjects. He didn't know Greek very well. You see, English doesn't have a word, really, to translate the biblical meaning of faith. They're action words. And if I could slip it in here, faith requires action in order to be faith. I've taught this to my people till it's old hat. But there are only two words translated in the New Testament, trust or faith. One means to run to the shelter of a rock, or to run to the shelter of a mother bird, her wings. You can see it, say there'll be shelter there, think about it, but until you run to appropriate the shelter, it doesn't qualify as trust. The other words, to lean on a staff. It was not unique to God. David was the first man in the Old Testament to take the word and apply it to God. That foul-mouthed emissary of Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, mocked the people on the walls of Jerusalem in Hezekiah's day and said, if you lean on that staff or the reed of Egypt, it'll break and pierce your hand and fester and create a sore in your hand. It wasn't unique to religion. It was to lean on anything. David grabbed the word and was the first man in history to apply it to God. Lean on God, translated trust. In the New Testament, pisteo is a verb. In Hebrews 11, pistis is the derivative of it from which we get faith. We ought to make a word up in English and turn it into a verb, fathers and faithing, because it's an act based on belief, support of a confidence. If I were a philosopher in Greece years ago, and the word still has the meaning in modern Greek today, I would teach pisteo as an action based upon belief, support of a confidence, and say, you cannot live in this world without actions that involve pisteo. You can't even drive through an intersection without hanging your body on the belief and having the confidence that people will stop at the red light and go at the green. You can't move and get up in the morning without assuming that when you move your foot forward, it'll hit the floor, not the ceiling. A faith in the gravitational pull that you can understand or not understand, but you act on the belief and you keep acting supported by confidence. You can't simply do anything. You can never prove you exist. You get up in the morning, act like you do. It's absolutely beyond capability of proof. And it took me many years in college to understand there is no such thing as no faith at all. The choice is which direction it'll flow. God reached down and said he would give salvation to those that make him and his word and his trustworthiness the basis of their action. God spoke, not a thing became everything. All of mankind is acting and hanging their body on what they see and feel. A hero of faith says God spoke and not a thing became everything. He didn't just rearrange. From nothing became everything. It consists by his word. It'll be rearranged by his word. You got a choice. Forever, O Lord, thy word settle in heaven. Circumstances contradict it. You got a choice. I'm going to reach up and grab it. Act like God's word's more real than what I see. I don't have to see the results here. Some die not having obtained the promise. But I'll act on God's word. God calls that faith. Pistis. Everything else, every other action, it doesn't mean it's bad necessarily. Could be if it is translated into absolute disbelief in God. But any action based on any belief source and confidence other than God and his faithfulness to his word is called apistis. It's faith going the wrong direction. You can't live without faith. You can only choose the object of your faith. Took me years to discover that. Now, there are people I love to point out as cynics belittle faith in God. History and science ain't been doing that good. How many people listening to me know that Darwin was an absolute fraud? A New York journalist proved he stole his theory from some poor guy that spent years in the Amazon and was lying on his sick bed with fever in the East Indies. And through his cronies, Darwin beat the guy who really discovered it to the publisher, to the announcement of it. You know, some people fighting evolution would be better off to just do their research. Now, if his idea is true, it ought to stand on its own feet like the words of a jackass. But Darwin was a fraud. In fact, there's a book out right now on frauds in science. You ought to read it. There's hardly any area of science that's not been victimized by fraud. History is exactly that. Now, a lot of Christians grab this and do something with it that was never intended. History is his story. That's all it is. His story. The guy who wrote it. William of Tyre is made the authority by other historians who don't want to do the research. He says the Templars were established in 1118, moved into the king's palace, and had no additions to their ranks for 9 years. 9 years, nobody's allowed to join. In 9 years, 1127, most of the nine knights returned to Europe, triumphal welcome. 1128, a church council was convened at Troyes, court of the Count of Champagne. St. Bernard was the guiding spirit, and the Templars were incorporated as a religious military order. They were allowed to be warrior monks, soldier mystics, militia of Christ, they were called at that time. Militia of Christ. They were sworn to poverty, chastity, and obedience. They were obliged to cut their hair, but forbidden to cut their beards. Diet, dress, and other aspects of daily life were stringently regulated. All members were obliged to wear white habits or surcoats and cloaks, which soon evolved into the distinctive white mantle of which the Templars became famous. It is granted, the Pope ordered, for none to wear white habits or have white mantles except the knights of Christ. Their behavior on the battlefield was strictly controlled. If captured, the Templars were not allowed to ask for mercy or to ransom themselves. They were compelled to fight to the death. They were never permitted to retreat unless the odds against them exceeded 3-1. In 1139, a papal bull was issued by Pope Innocent II, a former Cistercian monk at Clairvaux and protege of St. Bernard, who was the guiding church voice to give them their official status at the Council of Troyes. According to this bull, the Templars would owe allegiance to no secular or ecclesiastical power other than the Pope himself. They were made international, owing allegiance to no king in any area, only the Pope. In other words, they were rendered totally independent of all kings, princes, and prelates, and of all interference from both political and religious authorities. They became a law unto themselves and an autonomous international empire. During the 2 decades following the Council of Troyes, they expanded extraordinarily. When their grandmaster, alleged founder, Hugues de Payen visited England in late 1128. He was received with great worship by King Henry I. Throughout Europe, younger sons of noble families flocked to enroll in the order's ranks. Vast donations in money, goods, and land were made from every quarter of Christendom. They were the Pope's favorites. All new recruits on admission were compelled to sign over all possessions. Within 12 months of the Council of Troyes, the order held substantial estates in France, England, Scotland, Flanders, Spain, and Portugal. With another decade, it held territory in Italy, Austria, Germany, Hungary, the Holy Land, and points east. Although individual knights were bound to their vow of poverty, the order amassed great wealth, and on an unprecedented scale, all gifts were welcome. At the same time, there was an order forbidding them to dispose of anything. They couldn't even spend money to ransom their leaders. In 1130, that's 12 years later, isn't it? Hugues de Payen returned to Palestine with an entourage of 300 knights, and he left behind, in the custody of other recruits, vast tracts of European territory. 1146, they adopted the famous splayed red cross, the cross pate. From this device emblazoned on their mantles, the knights accompanied King Louis VII of France on the Second Crusade. During the next 100 years, Templars became a power with international influence, engaging in high-level diplomacy among nobles and monarchs throughout the Western world. In England, the master of the temple was regularly called to the king's parliament, was regarded as head of all religious orders, taking precedence over priors and abbots in the land. Maintaining close ties with both Henry II and Thomas à Becket, you that have seen the movie will tune in there, the Templars were instrumental in trying to reconcile the sovereign and his estranged archbishop. Successive English kings, including King John, often resided in the temple's London preceptory, and the master of the order stood by the monarch's side at the signing of the Magna Carta. Not just in the Christian world. They were international. They forged links with the Muslim world and commanded a respect from Saracen leaders, exceeding that accorded any other European. Secret connections were maintained with the Hashishim, or Assassins, one of the Islamic Shiite sects that on hashish would be committed, the first terrorists. This famous sect were Islam's equivalent to the Templars, and the Hashishim paid tribute to the temple and were rumored to be in its employ as paid assassins also. On almost every political level, the Templars acted as official arbiters in disputes. Even kings submitted to their authority. In 1252, I'm getting up to, history doesn't give you a clue. And these people are very accurate. William of Tyre is wrong. They didn't start in 1118. And there was, I think, nothing less than a deliberate attempt to hide from history their true beginnings and the source of their power. Their mysterious wealth may make a mystery as big as the priests. And it might be the same. We'll see, won't we? In 1252, Henry III of England dared to challenge them, threatening to confiscate certain of their domains. You Templars have so many liberties and charters that your enormous possessions make you rave with pride and haughtiness, King of England. What was imprudently given must therefore be prudently revoked, and what was inconsiderately bestowed upon you must considerately be recalled. The master of the order replied, What sayest thou, O king? Forbid it that thy mouth should utter so disagreeable and silly a word. So long as thou dost exercise justice, thou wilt reign. But if thou infringe it, thou wilt cease to be king. To the modern mind, it's difficult to impute the audacity of this statement to a king of the Middle Ages. whose word was law. They went beyond war, diplomacy, and political intrigue. In effect, they created and established the institution of modern banking. By lending vast sums to destitute monarchs, they became the bankers for every throne in Europe and for certain Muslim potentates as well. They were like the Rothschilds would become later. Still too cold in here. And for certain Muslim potentates as well. With their network of preceptories throughout... Am I boring you? You can't understand present without understanding history. With their network of preceptories throughout Europe and the Middle East, they also organized... You suppose they... Oh, well, let's go on. Organized at modest interest rates the safe and efficient transfer of money from merchant traders, a class that became increasingly dependent upon them. Money deposited in one city, for example, could be claimed and withdrawn in another by means of promissory notes inscribed in intricate codes. The Rothschilds did not originate it. The beginnings of bearer bonds, except codes identified. The Paris Preceptory became the center of European finance, and it's even probable that the check as we know it and use it today was invented by the Knights Templar. The Templars traded not only in money, but thought. They enjoyed a monopoly of the best and most advanced technology. They were a clearinghouse for new ideas. They had cadres of armorers, leather workers, stonemasons, military architects, and engineers. They contributed to the development of surveying, map-making, road-building, and navigation. They possessed their own seaports, shipyards, and fleet, a fleet both commercial and military, which was among the first to use the magnetic compass. And as soldiers, the Templars' need to treat wounds and illness made them adept in the use of drugs. The order maintained its own hospitals with its own physicians and surgeons, whose use of mold extract suggests an inkling of the properties of antibiotics. Herbiotics. Modern principles of hygiene and cleanliness were understood, and with a sophistication advanced for their time, they regarded epilepsy not as demoniac possession, but as a controllable disease. They were ahead of their time. Inspired by their own accomplishments, the temple in Europe grew increasingly wealthy, powerful, and complacent. At the same time, arrogant, brutal, and corrupt. To drink like a Templar became a cliché of the time. And certain sources indicate that the order made a point of recruiting excommunicated knights who, because of their unique position with the Pope, the excommunication could be lifted if they joined the Knights Templar. While they prospered in Europe, the situation in the Holy Land, where their temple originated, deteriorated. The king died. Dynastic squabbles followed. July 1187. A disastrous battle at Hattin. Christian forces virtually annihilated. 2 months later, Jerusalem, captured nearly a century before. Base of the Knights was again in Saracen Muslim hands. By 1291, the whole of Outremer, or the Holy Land, had fallen, almost entirely under Muslim control. Only Acre remained. May 1291, this fortress fell. They established a new headquarters in Cyprus, but on the surface they'd been deprived of their raison d'etre to protect pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. They had helped to found the Teutonic Knights that controlled the amber industry along the Baltic coast and had become an indigenous state all their own. They had had an international place, but they also had a kingdom, the kingdom of Jerusalem, Zion. Why they claimed that is part of the mystery we're going to look at. With the loss of Jerusalem, moving to Cyprus, they didn't have a reason for being. They began to look around for an independent kingdom of their own. Their eye fell on the southern France territories because of close ties they also had with the nobles of Cathar persuasion. They were notably sympathetic to the Cathars during the Albigensian Crusade. And as they begin to build up this strength, King Philip of France began to see them as a threat. An indigenous state like the Baltic state for the Teutonic Knights was about to spin off, including South France and Marseille. He hated the Templars because he owed them money, as many other rulers. On the surface, this seems to be the explanation. He feared the state and he had been rejected in applying for membership in their order, insultingly so. He began to move in on the Pope because their allegiance was the Pope. He participated in the kidnapping and death of one and the murder of a second. And then his own candidate, the Archbishop of Bordeaux, under the thumb of the French king, became the Pope Clement V, a puppet of Philip. In that sense, that to Philip he owed his papacy. He agreed to accept charges of heresy that were named against the Knights Templar, gave Philip the right to wipe them out in a move designed to move in secrecy. On one day, orders sealed went out to all of King Philip's henchmen, and they were to seize all the Knights Templar in one night. As we've already taught, a secret was not a secret. When they got to the Paris Preceptory, the treasure was gone. When they burned the last Grand Master at the stake, from which the De Molay Boys Club get their name, Jacques De Molay, or Jacques De Molay, he cursed both the king and the pope, who died shortly thereafter. He said, "You'll meet me before the bar." A mystical attachment fastens on to the Knights Templar. They are virtually wiped out in Europe and France. They remain strong in parts of England, very strong in Scotland. Did Philippe just have jealousy for being kicked out? Did he just resent the threat of a new state? Or was there something else that he knew about the Templars that gave them a power that he wanted to get? Well, the Knights Templar have a mystical side. We were reading about this strange story that continued to crop out as under Inquisition, the Knights Templar were persecuted throughout Europe. Strange, mystical, and from the Catholic view, and from, I guess, about any Christian view, heretical tendencies. The worst being a hatred for the cross of Christ. They would curse it and spit on it in secret ceremonies. They cursed the wearing of a cross. The most sensational was a secret ceremony where they were alleged to worship a head. And one of the stories that circulated is the one we've been teaching on. A great lady of Mariclea was loved by a Templar. Now, I don't have to review, do I? That there were several other head-worshipping mystical tales told. This is one of the most strange. A great lady, am I boring you? I can stop now. I thought I moved that review along quite fast. I mean, you know, I didn't tell you anything new, but I thought I moved it along pretty good. Now, if I could just keep the same pace. A great lady of Mariclea was loved by a Templar, a Lord of Sidon. But she died in her youth. And on the night of her burial, this wicked lover crept. Well, I've been going faster than a crept. Now, to get right into this story, feel it right, we got a crept. This wicked lover crept. Let's try it again. I don't know why I get hung up on this. This wicked lover. You know they're cussing me in Texas right now. They are not saying crept. They are spelling it in more ways than you can imagine. This wicked lover. You know why I'm not on Christian stations? Dead backslide. That, you know, when I'm on these sinner stations, you know, they just start right out being able to tell me what they think. This wicked lover. You know, I'm not too sure that he should be called lover. But I don't have to decide that. This wicked lover. Wrapped to the grave. Dug up her body and I'm not sure I can read this until after midnight. Dug up her body and what did he do? Violated it. He's a necrophiliac, that's what he is. Next person comes up to me and says, I got a word for you from the Lord. I'm going to say, get away from me, you necrophiliac, you! They won't know what I've called them. I have this mission to teach Christians how to cuss and nobody knows it. Now, see, I just do it. But like old Jake Miller used to say years ago, says, don't everybody try to do what I do. I teach you more sensitive Christians how to do it with grace. You know, caput mortuum, S-O-B, sons of Belial. I mean, God had that first. Evil men are called sons of Belial. It's very biblical to call people SOBs, sons of Belial. I do not believe in insulting dogs. Sons of Belial, what they are. Now here we got another one. Necrophiliac. Keep a little dictionary called Scott's Cussing Dictionary for Sensitive Christians. This wicked lover crept. What he did. Dug up her body and violated it. Then a voice from the void bade him return in 9 months' time, for he would find a son. Good enough for the necrophiliac. He thought he'd get away with it. Dirty rat. I mean, men have been getting away with things for years. The poor ladies, you know. They bear the brunt of it. Now this rat thought, man, she's dead. I'm really safe. Dirty rat. Good enough for him, boy. Telling you. Then a voice from the boy bade him return in 9 months, for he would find a son. He obeyed the injunction. And at the appointed time, opened. Put yourself in this guy's place. Just imagine what's going through his mind while he's digging the grass and the dirt away. He opened the grave again. Found a head on where it was last night, wasn't it? Found a head on thee. Leg bones of the skeleton. Don't you ever wonder where the skull and crossbones comes from? All of these things have a source somewhere. Why did pirates preempt it? Every time a question gets answered, there's a new one coming out. The same voice bade him. Quote. Now, whatever significance may be ascribed to the cull of the head, I'm going to save that for a minute. The Inquisition clearly believed it to be important. A list of charges against Knights Templar were drawn up August 12, 1308. And here is the list of charges. Item, that in each province they had idols, namely heads. Item, that they adored these idols, heads. Item, that they said that the head could save them. Item, that it could make riches. That it made the trees flower, that it made the land germinate, that they surrounded and touched each head of the aforesaid idol with small cords which they wore around themselves next to the shirt of the flesh. And they sought out Knights Templar to burn them at the stake, put them on the rack to make them confess to this. The same voice bade him, quote, I'll just wait right there. Where's that there? Knights Templars are full of mystery. Just leave that voice there for a moment. Huh? You want me to quit? If I move fast, I might get back to quote. The foundation and history of the order, when analyzed, doesn't wash. Nine poor knights, appeared as it were from nowhere, among all the other crusaders swarming about the Holy Land. Nine ragged knights. They promptly have the king's quarters turned over to them. Solomon's sight. Where his, to colon here now, where his stables were. Without admitting any new recruits to their ranks, just nine of them, presumed all by themselves to defend the highways of Palestine. Now, there's no record anywhere of them actually doing anything to defend anybody. The king's official chronicler must have known about them, but he doesn't say a word about them. No one says a word about the Knights Templar until 50 years go by, and they're already the biggest thing in Europe, and they can tell somebody how to write their history. William of Tyre, 50 years after they're formed, writes their history. What were they doing? They weren't engaged in any public service. No record anywhere of them guarding anybody. Maybe were they possibly involved in some clandestine activity to be kept under wraps until they were the power they became? Maybe because of what they've done, then they have an official story written. You know, the guy that wins the war determines how the history's written. I'm tired of Christianity being belittled as bad history. There is no subject in the world that's received the scrutiny that Christ and the Christ story has received. For years, history was written as though the Greco-Roman classical cultures dominated the world. Took C.S. Gordon to prove that it's a Hebrew origin coming out of Egypt, or that the Hebrews and the Greeks come from a common origin out of Egypt. One, the only one I'm really impressed about in the lost books of the Bible is one that the historians ascribed to the first century until they found on Elephantine Island, where Egypt had sent some mercenaries, Jews who didn't live in the Holy Land, and they dug up a copy of it that dates back to finds that can be dated to 500 B.C. Historians write his story. This is a fix. That's what it is. Oh, man, I got to move. If William Attire's right, there could have been no new members until 1127, 9 years after they were founded. But it's clearly on record that the Count of Anjou, father of Geoffrey Plantagenet, joined the order in 1120. There's a clear record to those that carefully look at their medieval records. Count of Anjou, Geoffrey Plantagenet, joined the order in 1120, 2 years after its supposed foundation. That makes him 10. And in 1124, the Count of Champagne, one of the wealthiest lords in Europe, also joined the order. Now, if William Attire, Guillaume de Tyre, is correct, there should have been no new members until 1127. But by 1126, the Templars, in fact, had admitted at least 4 new members to their ranks, so William's wrong going out the gate. And if the Count of Anjou became a Templar in 1120, and if the order admitted no new members for 9 years after its foundation would date not from 1118, but from 1111 or 12. Of course, look at the evidence for this. In 1114, 4 years before William said it was founded, the Count of Champagne was preparing for a journey to the Holy Land. Shortly before his departure, he received a letter from the Bishop of Chartres. At one point, the bishop wrote, "We've heard that before leaving for Jerusalem, you made a vow to join the Milice du Christ," the Militia of Christ, which was the original name for the Templars. This is 4 years they're supposed to be formed, and there is a record of the bishop writing to the Count of Champagne, one of the richest lords of Europe, indicating the bishop had heard he intended to join the Militia of Christ, that had to be there for him to join it, 4 years before William says it starts. That's the name St. Bernard uses. From the Bishop of Chartres' letter, it's clear the Templars existed as early as 1114, and that the Count of Champagne intended to join it. There are other circumstances. At least 3 of the 9 founding knights, including the first Grand Master, Hugues de Payen, seem to have come from adjacent regions, had family ties, knew each other previously, and been vassals of the same lord. 3 of the 9 knights, the records now show, were vassals. Servants, if you will, of the Count of Champagne, to whom the bishop wrote the letter, who did in fact become a Templar in 1124, pledging his own allegiance to his own vassal who founded it. In 1115, the Count of Champagne, who 4 years it was supposed to have been formed, according to William Attire, is written to by the bishop saying, "We understand you plan to join it." It isn't even existing yet. 3 of the 9 who formed it, allegedly to protect pilgrims in the highways of Jerusalem, were vassals of the Count. Before it's alleged to have been formed, he in fact joins it and pledges allegiance to his own vassal, and 1115, before, 3 years before it was supposed to be formed, Champagne donated the land on which St. Bernard, patron of the Templars, built the famous Abbey of Clairvaux, and one of the nine founding knights was St. Bernard's uncle. So you got a little conspiracy, very tight. They throw him over the court of the Count of Champagne, an influential school of Kabbalistic, that's the numerical, mystical school of Jewish studies, and esoteric studies had flourished since 1070. It was from Troy, court of the Count of Champagne, that one of the earliest Grail romances issued, maybe the earliest, composed by Chrétien de Troyes. Now, since it was interconnected people, one of the richest lords in Europe sent his own vassals to found it with this alleged protectionist desire, when in fact, he himself intended to follow them and join the order. They were all interconnected by family and otherwise. Was this a pre-planned clandestine activity? Planned to obtain the specific site of the knight's domicile, the wing of the royal palace, the Temple Mount, so inexplicably conferred upon them. In A.D. 70, the temple that had stood there was sacked by the Roman legions under Titus. His treasure was plundered, brought to Rome, then plundered again, perhaps brought to the Pyrenees by the Visigoths. But what if there was something else in the temple as well, something even more important than the treasure on the surface taken by the Romans? Among the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered recently at Qumran, there is one now known as the Copper Scroll. This scroll, deciphered at Manchester University in 1955 and 56, makes explicit reference to great quantities of bullion, sacred vessels, and additional unspecified material and treasure of indeterminate kind, citing 24 different hoards buried beneath the temple itself. You that have visited there, you know about the stables of Solomon. And if they got the site by any kind of conspiratorial deal and connection with the Pope, since it had been delivered through the Crusaders, they get the site of the temple and have the ability to begin excavating under the temple site immediately. Were they deliberately sent to the Holy Land with the express commission of finding something? In 1104, the Count of Champagne had met in conclave with certain high-ranking nobles, at least one of whom had just returned from Jerusalem. Among those present at this conclave were representative families, Brienne, Joinville, and Chaumont, later to figure in the story of the priest. Also was the liege lord of André de Montbard, André being one of the co-founders of the temple and uncle of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who becomes the most powerful religious order in Europe shortly thereafter. Almost immediately after the conclave, the Count of Champagne departed for the Holy Land himself, remained there 4 years, returning in 1108, 10 years before it was supposed to have been founded. The conclave in 1104. High-ranking nobles in Europe, one had just returned from Jerusalem. Shortly after the conclave, the Count of Champagne departs for the Holy Land, stays there 4 years, returns in 1108. In 1114, 4 years before William Attire says the knights reformed, he made a second journey to Palestine. A letter from the bishop indicates he was going to join the militia of Christ, the name of the Knights Templar. Changed his mind, returned to Europe, did in fact go and join, returned to Europe a year later. On his return, he immediately donated a tract of land to the Cistercian order, whose preeminent spokesman was St. Bernard, and on this tract of land, St. Bernard built the Abbey of Clairvaux, where he established his own residence and then consolidated the order. Prior to... Yeah, get out of the line of these things. That's what's causing the problem. Prior to 1112, the Cistercian order of St. Bernard were dangerously close to bankruptcy. Under St. Bernard's guidance, they underwent a dazzling change of fortune, just like the story of the priest. Are you counting me out of Dallas? See you tomorrow night. Play come over here. I got to quit right here. I can't leave Dallas out. Sing, Lord. How did the time go by? Did